I was asked to talk about creating LGBTQ welcoming clinics. I work in an FUHC. It's a little bit about it here. I just want to say that I started very enthusiastically doing a lit review to see what had been shown that improved health outcomes for LGBTQ people, and there's actually nothing written. So I thought the best thing to do would be to talk about my experiences working at Callenwood, and then to kind of show some of the documents that describe best practices, which again are not based on any RCT. So I work at Callenwood. We're a federally qualified health center, and we provide LGBTQ health services. And we see a lot of folks. It's a very diverse population. You know, half of our clients are, you know, would be classified as living in poverty, and we see we have the largest clinic of transgender clients, I think, in the country. We have over 3,000. So just a little bit about us and where the experience comes from. I'm going to present two short cases and then talk about what we can do better. Okay. So the first is Cases TD. This was a 38-year-old woman, a white trans woman, who came into the clinic, and she had been having some vaginal discharge and odor and some post-coital bleeding for about 10 months. And she does engage in condomless receptive anal and vaginal sex with one male partner. Now, she had, a few years ago, had a penile inversion vaginoplasty, so creation of a vagina. She did that in Thailand and has been incredibly healthy that she thinks of, no medical issues. Some of her transition history, she did transition when she was 20. She started hormones from friends, and she's been taking estradiol tablets, which she gets over the internet. And she's been out of care since she came back from Thailand. She doesn't know where to get care. She's had previous poor experiences accessing health care in the United States. So, you know, she dilates with a dilator since her surgery. So on exam, you know, she has a watery discharge. She has papillomatous lesions along the introitus and the vaginal wall. And, you know, TCA was applied. They looked like genital warts. And she followed up 2 weeks later, and in fact, yes, that's what it was. And luckily, all her screening tests were negative for gonorrhea and chlamydia, and the HIV screen was negative. The second case is a 28-year-old African-American who's an accountant, also healthy, but comes in now with 48 hours of fever, sore throat, swollen glands, you know, and a rash. And he's had three male sexual partners in the last 6 months. Says he uses condoms pretty consistently and had a checkup with his provider, but has never discussed his sexuality with his PCP, his primary care provider, and is not sure that he's ever been tested for HIV or STIs. Now, you know, this is kind of classic for acute HIV, and indeed it was. I mean, the rapid HIV screen was negative, but the viral load was, you know, extremely high. So I wanted just to talk about, you know, what's different with LGBTQ clients. I mean, we know that, you know, technically we're one of the six most underserved minority groups in the U.S., but I wanted to talk about, you know, what really is going on with our clients when they're in front of us, and what keeps them out of care, and what delays care for them, and how can we improve that? So as you know, when we talk about healthcare disparities or differences in risks or within certain populations, you know, you have to be thinking about those people. So when we talk about LGBTQ folks, we're talking about higher rates of stigma and discrimination, both, you know, the enacted stigma as well as internalized stigma, and also the fear of facing healthcare environments that are not welcoming. So this is actually from a document that was published by the Association of American Medical Colleges that really nicely outlines, you know, all the different types of trauma that LGBTQ clients face as they're accessing healthcare. You know, all the baggage that comes along with them, the fact that many of them have faced verbal harassment, physical assault. You can see the numbers here. You know, almost half of bisexual women have been raped in their lifetime. You know, same number of bisexual men have experienced lifetime sexual violence, and so on. And especially for trans clients, extreme trauma that's been faced in their lifetime. So this is for adult. You've heard about what children have faced in the previous talk. And also older adults. We don't know that much about older LGBT folk, but again, high rates of lifetime rates of physical violence, emotional, psychological abuse, and so forth. So when clients come in, you know, they have all of that, as well as the fact that they're facing barriers to care, to healthcare. So this is a study that was done in New York City from the Empire State Pride Agenda, along with the Department of Health, where they actually asked around 3,500 LGBTQ people around the state, you know, what are your issues accessing healthcare? And as you can see here, and I don't know if it shows up, but I'll read, you know, the fact that doctors and other healthcare workers refuse to provide services to LGBT people, a fear that they will treat them differently. I mean, these are all, this is, you know, outright discrimination in healthcare. So this is just one study. Also, Lambda Legal conducted a survey that included around 6,000 folk, again, the LGB and trans and gender nonconforming, and also looked at the experiences of people in healthcare. And as you can see here, you know, there are high rates of people being, you know, actually physically assaulted, people denying them care. You know, I've had clients tell me that providers won't touch them unless they're wearing gloves, and that's just to talk to them. And regardless of the barriers, they're always much, much higher for people who are trans and gender nonconforming compared to the LGB, and they're much, much more, as you'll see, for people who are ethnic minorities and racial minorities. So just some from another study that was done, the National Transgender Discrimination Survey, that looked at trans clients and the fact that they anticipated discrimination. And this is what keeps people out of care, that they, you know, they either experienced this or that someone else has experienced it. So they fear they'll be refused care, treated differently, and also that healthcare providers just aren't adequately trained to provide appropriate care for them. And because of that, you'll see a third of trans clients actually delaying their care, whether it's preventive care or urgent care. So, you know, sitting at home with chest pain, which is something that I've seen happen with clients who didn't want to go into the emergency room. So, you know, we talk about LGBT health disparities. So, you know, there's all this trauma that's going on. People are staying out of health care. They're not getting preventive care. And, of course, there are going to be health disparities. So, you know, we've seen all of these in our clinic, but this is actually from the IOM report. You know, higher rates of smoking, depression, anxiety, suicidality, you know, up to 40% of trans clients have attempted suicide in their lifetime, for example. High rates of substance use. For lesbian bi women, you're looking at higher rates of overweight and obesity. We know that for MSM and for trans women, there's higher rates of HIV and STIs. And a few things you may not have known about, like higher rates of osteoporosis amongst trans women, or higher rates of stroke and heart attacks among trans women. And then, you know, pap smears, that's, you know, preventive care, but lower rates of pap smears being done for lesbian-identified cis women and transgender men. So, you know, I think the biggest thing, though, is around disclosure. And we should be thinking of the fact that people don't disclose their sexual orientation and gender identity as a health disparity. In the New York study, they found that, you know, about half of people, you know, could say that they strongly agreed with being out to their medical provider. And why is this even important, right? There was one really interesting study that looked at disclosure of sexual orientation and uptake of HIV testing and hepatitis vaccination. This was a study done in rural settings across the US. And it basically showed this, that when people were out to their, when gay men were out to their medical providers, they were so much more likely to actually be screened for HIV and to receive the appropriate vaccinations. And why do people not disclose? Because their providers just don't ask. And, you know, you think perhaps that it's not important, or you might feel that, you know, a bit awkward about bringing this up if you're not asked. So, you know, how do we go about improving the environment for LGBT people in clinics and how do we improve on disclosure of LGBT identity? And there's some really good response in the New York survey on this. You know, I feel people in my neighborhood need greater access to quality, affordable health care. Often LGBT access to healthcare has nothing to do with queer-specific issues, but rather with how we are treated during routine medical exams. Having well-informed and sensitive staff would probably help. So that's really what I'm going to talk about today. And I have lots of pictures because I want to kind of show what the environment is like. Okay, so imagine you're someone who comes into the clinic and you're, you know, gay or lesbian or bi or someone of trans experience, and you're standing in front of the desk and there's someone there. Who's going to greet you? And how are they going to greet you? And how are you going to respond to that? And what documents are they going to ask you for? Especially if you're someone who's trans-identified and maybe you haven't updated your name or your gender marker yet. And what's the paperwork that you're going to have to fill out? Okay? So, you know, it's really so important when you go back to your own environments, to your own clinics, to just do an environmental kind of look through. You know, they always say, is this a welcoming place? If I walk in, am I going to feel like I'm welcomed and I belong? So, you know, thinking about, you know, what's on the walls, what are the images, gender-neutral restrooms, has the staff been trained not to use gendered language, okay? So we train our clinic staff, especially at the front desk, you know, to not use gendered language. Don't use ma'am and sir, you know, Mr. and Mrs. and so on, because you don't know what someone's gender is unless you've actually asked them first. So, you know, using gender-neutral forms of address, you might have heard if you went to the last talk, the two-step process for gender identity, which, you know, instead of just giving people a box, male and female, that you're asking about gender identity and you're also asking about sex assigned at birth, so that you know what you need to know about people. And this is our very busy, and I'm sorry I didn't come out too well, a registration form at Callan Lord. But, you know, we ask people's legal name for billing. We also ask them the name they want us to use for them, the name they use in everyday life. We ask the sex assigned at birth and gender identity. We ask people what their sexual orientation is. We also ask them who they have sex with, because, as you know, that can be discordant. So this is just one example of a registration form. And, you know, and then we have, what is your gender? But we also have what is the gender that we need to use for billing, because, you know, sometimes, again, those may not be the same. So we try and, affirm everyone who walks into our setting. You know, you need to do this also for electronic health records. You can do it at the front desk, but what happens then when you're behind closed doors, right? And the provider or the nurse is constantly mispronouncing you or using the wrong name. So you really have to make sure that it goes into the electronic health records too. So I don't know if you can see this, but ours asks sex assigned at birth and also asks preferred pronoun, so you can't make a mistake there. And we also do this in the sexual health templates. We also ask the same questions again. And, you know, sometimes they change. So we do ask people how they want to be. I don't know if this is going to work, but let's see if it does. Maybe not. Okay. I had a really wonderful video, but you're going to miss that. So what I wanted to say is we actually wear buttons in our facility that, you know, so you can actually, you don't have, you know, people can wear it, staff can wear them, saying what their pronoun is. Materials. It's very hard to find materials that reflect the LGBT communities that are good, right? So, you know, creating those is incredibly important. So these were some of the materials we made for pre-exposure prophylaxis, because we realized our trans-identified clients were not enrolling in the PrEP program. So we created all our own materials because we couldn't find them anywhere. But I think there are more coming out. So, you know, screening for depression and PTSD, you know, shown you the incredibly high rates of trauma that people experience. So screening is one of the really definite things that you can do to make your clinic, LGBT affirming. So, you know, we do PHQ 2 and 9. There are short screens for PTSD, just four questions. It doesn't take much time. But if you have more than three of these positive, or three plus positive, then you know that this is a person who's experienced PTSD, and you can make the appropriate referrals. So, you know, sexual health is really huge, right? Because, you know, whether you're a cisgender lesbian or a trans man or a trans woman, you know, or a gay man, you may have a lot of discomfort discussing the type of sex that you're having or discussing your body and what you're doing with it. So, you know, we've all learned about the five P's, asking the questions and so on. But, you know, it's a little bit more, right? It's a little bit more when you have LGBT folk, especially trans folk in front of you. You know, establishing that everything is confidential, even though it, you know, it should be, but it's necessary before you start every conversation. You know, asking people, do they want a friend or chaperone? I've shown you a picture of what we have on the walls. You know, we ask people, do you want a chaperone? It can be a friend, anyone of any gender. Tell us who you want, or you can have a staff member. And you can choose also the gender of the staff member if you wish. Not assuming, don't make assumptions, not assuming gender identity or sexual orientation, and again, using gender-neutral terms. And building rapport with clients is really pretty essential. You know, this is the one time you're really going to have to explain in detail what you're going to do and why you're going to do it, especially with trans folk. You know, it's not just that you're having sex with men, women, or both, because you might be having sex with other trans people. So asking about relationships, past and present, and partners, and genders of partners, and you know, what body parts you're using, and how you're being exposed to your partner's fluids, and how you protect yourself are all really important conversations to have. And trying to stay away from kind of binary terms is important too. So I know I'm going through this quickly because I only have 5 minutes. This is you know, about gender inclusive language again for genital exams. You know, I try and make things easy when I'm examining clients by, you know, I talk about internal organs and external organs, and I talk about skin, and that usually kind of covers everything. But having a conversation, because you may have, for example, a woman of trans experience who is referring to her anus as her vagina, and it can get very confusing sometimes if you're not really certain of the language that people are using. So I try and go through that at the very beginning. You know, we have, we noticed that for our trans clients, and I'll show you our quality indicators later, but people were not getting screened for STIs. Actually, our, you know, gay and bi men weren't getting screened enough for, you know, anal, gonorrhea, and chlamydia either. We noticed that when we implemented an STI self-swab program that we actually increased our screening rates by about 40%. So this was really quite amazing. We're actually about to implement one for anal paps as well. So, you know, now people can actually just go to the lab, swab themselves, you know, and that's it. And we make the information available. Insurance navigation, we know that people have lower rates of insurance, especially for trans folk, but again, LGB as well. So having insurance navigation that takes into account what people's needs are as far as, you know, accessing PrEP, for example, or HIV care. You know, client education, you can see, I did a picture here of a room, and you can see, I don't know if you can see on the walls, but there's information about trans masculine groups, and there are pictures of, you know, same kind of gender couples, and that's all pretty important too. You know, engaging in community, so being out there and letting your clinic be known as a place that's affirming is really important. That was from Pride. Quality management. You're going to have to see how, you know, are there disparities that exist in your center? And no matter how good you are, you're going to see them. They're going to be, you know, racial and ethnic differences. They're going to be differences for amongst your, you know, between your heterosexual identified clients and LGB clients and so on. But here, just mapping out, we look at HOT is our youth program. Green was trans and gender nonconforming, and this was about whether or not people had been tested in the last 12 months. So we track about 10 different things, and we track them for all populations. This is like one of the last slides, but organizational structure and culture, it has to start, you know, it's bottom up and, you know, from the top down. You need to have a commitment from everyone in your staff. So, you know, in doing the health equality index survey, so you can get like a, you know, a badge, the LGBT affirming, including SOGI and the discrimination policy, non-discrimination policy, you know, quality indicators, staff diversity. You're going to have to hire people that look like the people you want to come in, right? That's just the way it is. So, and again, relationship with the community, a community advisory board, patient surveys, and also participating in referral networks. Some great pictures from New York City. You know, images mean so much in our communities. And knowing that you can actually get all of this, you know, sexual health guides, you can get information about PEP and PrEP, that you can talk about, you know, cancer prevention, you can find the images out there if you look. So I think this is the final. So improving access and care. So using language that's sensitive, you know, inclusive registration, two-step question, non-discrimination policies. I didn't talk a lot about cultural competency and cultural humility for trainings for staff, but you're going to have to do that too. And if you want to go for more resources, everything that I've spoken about is also pretty much documented as best practice. So Joint Commission, GLMA also has a guide. The National LGBT Health Education Center also has resources. Fenway Health, Callanwood, and the UCSF Center of Excellence for Transgender Health all have CME materials that you can use if you're wondering where to go.